Hi, I'm Lisa Levin.
And I'm Julie Sapper.
We're the co-founders of Run Farther and Faster and co-hosts of the podcast under the same name.
Well, we started this podcast as a Boston Marathon-focused podcast based on the experiences from our combined 31 finishes. We cover all things running-related.
We've coached runners of all levels and goal distances all over the world for over 13 years.
Thanks so much for joining us. We are so excited you're here.
Hey, Julie.
Hey, Lisa. How's it going?
It's going. I feel like we're kind of in the May madness phase of the year, right? Like when personal life stuff, when school year is coming to an end, and seems to be a busy time for everybody. So I know we've been talking to a lot of runners lately about coaching them for their fall races. And a common theme I'm getting from a lot of people is I can't focus on it until after, you know, until June, which is fine. You know, gives people plenty of time to train, but a lot of people are just like, I need May to like, I got to just get through the end of the school year, graduations, whatever is going on. It just seems like a busy month.
Oh yeah, for sure. I'm very happy to have a full house. Noah's home from college. So it's just so nice to have both my kids under. It's weird. I will never adjust to having one away. It's weird. And I'll be an empty nester after next year. And that's like so crazy. And you'll be an empty nester in 2 years. And that's crazy. And I won't go off on this tangent, but I can't ever imagine that this will feel super normal. It's just something I accept. So when Noah comes home, I'm like, oh yeah, this is normal to me, but I'm sure it's not to him. Do you remember what it was like when you were in college and then you come home? It's so hard.
Oh my gosh. So hard, right?
I mean, I graduated exactly 30 years ago this week from college, and a lot of my friends from college and I have been talking about that. And of course, so many of their kids are graduating as well. And it's really surreal, but I just have vivid memories of coming home after college and just feeling like a boss, like I knew everything. So let's just say I have empathy for Noah. Like I understand how smart he feels. And
well,
I also
independent, right? Independent. Mm-hmm. Like we lived for, you know, however many months we were gone without any rules, without curfews. I worry about that. It seems like a tough transition to go back to that after your kids have been, you know, in independent living for almost a year.
Yeah. I feel like hopefully for him right now, the positives outweigh the negatives, which are, you know, he gets home cooked meals. He loves to eat. And he doesn't have to think about it. And I think his bed at home is a lot more comfortable than the one in college. So at least for now.
Does he have a room by himself in college? Does he have a room by himself, or does he share a room?
No, he shares a room. So
right.
I think
so now he has a room by himself. Like he doesn't have anybody in his room with him. That's really, I remember that feeling of coming home and being like, oh, this quiet room, nobody here. Like I don't have to worry about a roommate.
For sure. And then also what's really funny for me is my pantry is filled with all of these potions and protein powders because teenage boys and young boys love protein powder. So I've got like all kinds of jugs of crap in my pantry that I've never seen before that he's, you know, putting into his shakes and whatnot. And I know that's totally normal, but it's just really funny because I don't drink that stuff. So it's just funny to see all these protein powders and stuff all over my house.
That's really funny. Well,
so anyway,
enjoy it though. Enjoy it.
Thank you. I am. I totally am. Okay. So we have a great interview coming up. And before we do, we just want to kind of talk about it a little bit. We interviewed an author. Her name is Maggie Mertens. And Maggie is going to be releasing her new book in June. It's called Better, Faster, Farther, How Running Changed Everything We Know About Women. And Maggie herself is a writer, journalist, and editor in Seattle. And she's, her work has appeared in The Atlantic, NPR, Sports Illustrated, Glamour. And so she decided to take on this topic, and she'll talk about why she wanted to write about women's running. But the one common theme that you and I both identified when we read the book and when we talked to Maggie was that things don't appear as they seem. And that is the case in science and on how things are reported in the media. So, yeah. So this book talks about the trajectory of women's running. And women were portrayed in the media as weak, frail, unable to execute even an 800 without falling apart. And she talks about the history of that. And it really made you and I pause because, of course, some of it was rooted in science and what scientists thought about women and running and what it did to our bodies back then. But then another part of it was the reporting of it wasn't even true, where journalists were basing their reporting on other journalists who reported the information wrong because, frankly, they were scared about portraying women as being strong because that's not feminine. And so it really got us thinking about that and how that even can apply to today.
Yeah, I agree. That was something that stuck with me. And we talked with Maggie a little bit about this, how, you know, you'd think over the years that we've had a lot of developments and we've had progress, and we have, but that some of this common themes still stick there. And I think it was a good reminder, especially in today's day and age, when we have so many sources of information, of how do we consume the information? How do we look at it critically? How do we analyze it? And how do we kind of look behind what we're, you know, the face value of what we're reading? And as coaches, this is really important to us because we're always looking for more information, more knowledge, education, understanding the issues and the different topics that affect us and the runners that we coach. And we've seen it over the years where we'll like have some knowledge that we think is just kind of standard knowledge and rules that are typically followed, and until we delve into it, like, well, why are we saying that? And does that apply in this case? And to think more critically and to, like, again, kind of check our sources and look at many different sources, not rely on any one particular source. But it is interesting to me how so many societal norms have influenced both the science and the media, or the, you know, the journalistic side of it, how societal norms sort of shape that.
Yeah. And even just thinking about things we've seen evolve, here's an example. When I was pregnant, I wasn't exactly discouraged from running, but I was told it was so important that I keep my heart rate lower than, I think it was like 145 or something like that. And running was sort of looked at as, yeah, you can run, especially because you've run before your pregnancy, but, you know, just be really careful. And I feel like I'm seeing an evolution even with how pregnant women, how doctors treat pregnant women and how they perceive running. I know just recently a pregnant woman won a half marathon, and she, of course, was already a very fast runner and running at an elite level. But the fact that she raced hard and won, and that's something that I think years ago may have been perceived as a negative thing. And now, of course, it's a positive thing. At the same time, we are very careful about that because everyone feels different in their pregnancy. And we never want someone who's pregnant to feel that they are less than because they can't run. Sometimes running just doesn't work when you're pregnant, but that doesn't mean that you're not a great athlete. It just means that you are not someone meant to run hard during pregnancy. Maybe that baby is sitting right on your bladder, and every time you run, things just aren't working out well. That doesn't mean that you can't get back to running and run strong. And it certainly doesn't mean that running is bad, but it means it's not great for you because you don't feel great when you're running and you're peeing at the same time.
Well put. Absolutely.
Yeah. So, and then the other part of it, of course, is Maggie talked a lot in her book about the way journalists portrayed runners. And like they would describe, for example, Mary Decker, who is one of the fastest runners on record, who, of course, never became an Olympian. And her most famous race was a race that didn't work out for her against Zola Budd. But Mary was described in the media as tiny and beautiful, and they, it was very important that her physical features be shared. And I mean, I wonder when we're going to get away from that, because I have to say, I don't think we've evolved that much. I feel like the people who are have the most followers on social media in terms of running often are the most attractive in terms of what is traditionally perceived as attractive. And I don't think it's a coincidence. And I don't know the answer to it, but I do know that it's really important that we have representation of all bodies in running, and we have representation of all types of physicalities. And we can't have that if the representation is elevated based on one type of body or one type of physical characteristic.
Right. And I do feel like we're heading in the right direction on that. But like I said, it's really interesting to see that a lot of the same biases and norms that shaped some of the earlier perceptions that we can look back at and say, wow, can you believe that this is what people thought, or this is was the common knowledge? Some of those biases still exist today. So it's just, I think her book was a good just a good delve into the really like looking at the source of the biases over the years, and sort of the disadvantage that women have going into running in particular. So I thought it was just a very thought-provoking.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. So speaking of thought-provoking, we have, as you mentioned, we've been talking to a lot of runners this week as people have been reaching out to us for coaching for the fall. And so we're doing a lot of intake calls. And one common theme that we're noticing that we just want to highlight is people are finding that they're just running a bit too fast right now during this sort of in-between time. And we talk about this a lot on the podcast, but it's worth repeating. After you finished your spring marathon, before you start your fall marathon training, it's a great opportunity to catch up with friends, to run with people maybe that you don't ordinarily run with, or run by yourself. But you're not going to get fitter by running your easy runs faster. You're just going to get more tired. So keep focusing on making sure that you maintain an easy pace while you're just maintaining your fitness. And if you want to run faster, designate a speed day, or go do a race. But try really hard not to push on your easy runs just because you're not marathon training right now. It's still not going to benefit you by running in that gray zone. It's just going to make you not recover as well to run the next run. And worst case scenario, it can lead to injury because you're depleting yourself without giving your body enough time to absorb the work. And then you're running yourself into the ground, running the next workout. And you're feeling like it's okay because you're not running as many miles as you did in marathon training, but maybe you're not resting as much either. So just be really mindful of your training during this in-between time before you start focused training, whether that's for a marathon, half marathon, whatever your fall goals are. Try not to waste all this good training by running yourself into the ground.
Yeah, one thing I do, and I think you've been doing it too, we talked about this a little last week, is I sprinkle in like 5Ks, maybe a 10K, but 5Ks into my spring and summer training. Which, because if I run a hard 5K on the weekend, like I feel like, I absolutely need to run easier during the week. So I feel like it prevents me. And if I know I'm running a 5K coming up, I'm certainly going to be making sure I'm running easier. So it gives me a specific day, to do the fast work, and then the rest of the week I can relax, and I know that, I don't need to be running fast. So I like doing that. I know you've enjoyed doing that, and I think that's a good thing. We've been talking to a lot of the runners that we're talking about coaching for the fall, is to go out and do a couple 5Ks this summer and get a baseline of where's your speed at, and you can use that to extrapolate some likely half marathon finish times and have a baseline. And this is a good time to do that because, I said, if your mileage is lower, get out, do a 5K, run easier the rest of the week, but get your speed in at the 5K.
Yeah, and if possible, don't do your long run the day before the 5K because that just won't work out well. But if you're someone where you don't have the luxury or the flexibility to do your longest run of the week during the week, and you want to run the 5K on a weekend, what you can do is you can build in like a couple of miles to warm up for your 5K, which is you should do anyway. And then you can do a couple more miles of cool down, and boom, there you've got like a medium to long run with a 5K built in.
Yeah, Julie, that brings to mind, like, I don't know if you remember us doing like that, like South Lakes, maybe it was the South Lakes, the one from, in Reston.
Yes.
I think we did like the South Lakes 10K one year where we went out there and we did a run together, easy run together. Then we did the 10K and then we did an easy run after. So we've done that before actually together. And I actually like, I think that's a nice way to mix up, a long run too. And also the fact of the matter is, if you just coming off a marathon and you're going to be transitioning to another training cycle, you don't need a long run every week. So instead of doing a long run, do a 5K. Like I do that. Like if I'm doing a 5K, I'm not going to be doing a long run, and I'm not going to be mixing in more miles to make it a long run because I don't feel like I need it right now. You don't need a long run every week right now. So you could just
No.
do a 5K or a 10K instead.
Yeah, and you did a fun 10K over the weekend. You want to talk about that race? Because I never really heard details on it. It sounds really cool.
Yeah, it was a fun one that I decided to do. called Run the Greenway at 5K and 10K. It's here in Northern Virginia. And we have a toll road, the Dulles toll road, that then turns into the Dulles Greenway. And they actually closed down the Greenway, which is a big, you know, it's a big multi-lane, I wouldn't say highway, but it is. It's a Greenway. And they close it down, which I think is really neat. So they get a lot of runners. It was a big race. I just saw, I came across my Facebook feed and I thought that looks like a fun, you know, something fun and different. And they have a 5K and a 10K. So it's out and back, and there's turnarounds for the 5K, there's turnarounds for the 10K. Like I said, they closed down the whole Greenway, and it's a well-organized race. A couple of pieces of feedback I would have if anyone's going to run it in the future. They start the 5K runners first, 10 minutes before I think the 10K goes off. And there are a lot. There were, I don't know if it was 1,000, but there were a lot of 5K runners, and there are a lot of 10K runners too. And it took about 10 minutes to get everybody over the start because some people came late and didn't realize the 5K had started. And so, and a lot of, there were a lot of walkers, which is great, and walkers doing the 5K, but you're on the same road. So 10 minutes later, they start the 10K. And so for the first 1.55 miles of the 10K, you're really having to weave through all of the kind of the back of the 5K group, which was, again, it's a very wide road. It's shut down the entire wide road, but it's still, it's a lot of walkers and a lot of people across. The other thing that I noticed is that the turnaround for the 5K was right at 1.55 miles, and the turnaround for the 10K was at 3.3 miles. And so I tried to, wah, wah. I tried to think in my head, yeah, wah, wah. And actually is very morally like kind of get dejected when you realize, like, you look at your watch and I'm like, okay, I should be at a certain point when I do the turnaround, and there's no turnaround in sight. There's no mile marker in sight, like nothing. And you're like, well, wait a minute, what's going on? So it gets a little, it was a little hard. And then in my mind, I'm trying to trick myself that, okay, well, maybe the way back is shorter. But it's an hour back, right? There's no, the start line and finish line are in the same place. They don't move the start finish line back. So in my head, I'm like, well, maybe it curves some way that this is going to, we're going to make this up or like something. No. So yeah, I compared my watch with a couple other people who finished around me around like, oh, what do you have? 6.6? Yeah, about 6 points, somewhere, anywhere between like around 6.6, 6.65 miles. So it was longer than a 10K, but it was fun. It was a nice race. And I just, it was a nice change of scenery. And I really like that they shut down the Greenway and you get to run on this road that you'd never normally, you know, ever, I don't know if you ever do this, but sometimes I'm driving down a highway and I'm like, wouldn't it be cool if they had a race here and you can just like, they shut down the Beltway. Wouldn't that be cool if they shut down the Beltway? You could run on the Beltway. So sometimes I think that, and that was the case. And I went into it thinking, oh, it would be so like nice and flat. It's not. It was very gradual up, very gradual down. So there was some elevation change, but yeah, it was a fun race, really well. It was on May the 4th, so they made it May the 4th be with you was the theme. So they had a lot of Star Troopers and whatever those things that I don't know what they are, but it was a really fun themed race. And you know, that's, I enjoy doing that. I enjoy going and just jumping into shorter. And that was the other thing. I hadn't done a 10K in about 5 years, so I decided It confirmed that I hate 10Ks, because 10Ks to me feel like a 5K. It's just double the distance. So that kind of sucks. I'm
totally with you. I don't like them either. And they used to be a lot more popular. Do you remember? Like,
yes, we had so many 10Ks, right? We
were just common.
Yeah, there are hardly any 10Ks anymore. There's Pike's Peak here, but that was, you know, right after Boston for us. But yeah, so that was another part of it. It was like, I like to just do different things, like in the, you know, in this time of year, is like, let me try some different things and some fun things that I wouldn't normally do. So I don't know if I'm going to do another 10K anytime soon, but it was fun.
That's awesome. Yeah, I would definitely try that sometime. So I'll try to remember that for next year. It sounds really fun. And yeah. I rarely do 10Ks for that reason. There is a 10K coming up. I believe it's next weekend. It's Lawyers Have Heart. Lawyers Have Heart used to be a June race, but it's moved to May.
They moved the location. I just saw that. I was sending it to a runner. That's interesting.
I'm not happy about that. I used to be on the board for Lawyers Have Heart, and I really enjoyed that time when I was on it. And after I left, I think the focus of the race kind of went from being more of a running event to more of a charity event. So although it is a timed race, it's not the same as it used to be in terms of being like a competitive event. It's more about raising money. And of course, it's a great cause. But for those interested in doing Lawyers Have Heart, it comes up quickly. It is in May now, and it's at Haynes Point. So it's a faster course than the one in Georgetown. But I know you and I both talked about this. We really love that old course. It was fun to be in Georgetown running that race. So maybe one day it'll be brought back there. And then I just want to give a shout out to my daughter because tomorrow is her last track meet. Ella, for the first time ever, ran track for high school, and she's a junior, and she is does not identify as a runner, but she is because she's been running all season, and she decided to try it. I had nothing to do with this decision, and I'm gonna give myself a pat on the back because I really stayed out of it completely. The only type of coaching I did at all was sometimes I would let her, don't tell the coach, skip practice because I didn't want her running hard every single day, which was what was happening. And I wanted her to avoid shin splints, which she did mostly. And so she has her last meet tomorrow. And it's really been great to watch her care about whittling her times down. She really understood the assignment right away. I'm not trying to be the fastest. She knew she wasn't by a large margin, but she was just trying to better herself. And that is what running is all about. So my hope for Ella when this is over, and I think this will be the case, is that she will find joy in running well after high school and look back on this season as a really fun experiment. It is not her primary sport, and I think she got a lot of camaraderie out of it. And I'm proud of her putting herself in an uncomfortable situation and having a good time. So, yeah, so I was a track mom this season, went to those meets. It was a lot of fun. Mad props for especially indoor track parents, which I never had the experience of being because those meets are even longer. So props to you and your kids. And it was really fun to be part of that community. I was part of the cross country community in the high school with Noah, but track I had never been a part of. And it was really fun to be a parent this season and do that. So anyway.
Well, congratulations to Ella. That's very exciting.
thank you. So, well, Lisa, I hope you have a great week. Oh, and congrats on your race. You didn't share this, but you actually, of course, won your age group. So now you're 2 for 2 as a newly minted 50-year-old runner. So congratulations. Let's keep the streak going, Lisa.
Thank you. Thank you. I'll try. I'm
I
taking
believe in
advantage of
you.
every minute of the first few days and weeks of 50 years old. So
I believe you can. I have no
thank
doubt.
you. Thanks,
So,
Julie.
without further delay, here's our guest, Maggie Mertens. Lisa, I hope you have a great week.
You too, Julie.
Bye.
Bye.
Maggie Mertens, welcome to the Run Farther and Faster podcast. We are so excited that you're joining us today, right before you launch your new book. You are, of course, the author of Better, Faster, Farther: How Running Changed Everything We Know About Women. And of course, we love the title. As the founders of Run Farther and Faster. So, besides the book being really great, we thoroughly enjoyed it. We also had to interview you, obviously, because of the title of your book. So, welcome and let's get started. Tell us a little bit about yourself, Maggie, including your running background.
Yeah, thanks for having me. So I grew up in the Pacific Northwest in Seattle. I was an 80s and 90s kid, so I was very much like thrown into sports. That was what we did. And I also grew up with four brothers, and so I think that's where a lot of my interest in gender comes from too, is, just really growing up in this environment that was very male, and people were kind of always telling me like, oh, are you okay? Like, do you wish you had a sister? Like this and that. And I loved it. Of course, that's what I knew. But one thing that I think really impacted the way that I got into sports was that it wasn't treated any different for me. Like our parents, signed us up for the same things. They played baseball, I played t-ball. I hated t-ball, so I didn't keep going. But like, what we all played was soccer. And I loved soccer. And at one point, I actually did decide to quit ballet so that I could keep playing soccer, because that was what the decision that my mom brought to me. Because there were five of us, and only so much time for activities. And yeah, even as a really young kid, I remember like the joy of just like running around on the playground and racing your friends and racing the boys in your class and things like that. And I was always doing the, elementary school sign up for track and field and cross country, and I just loved it. I just felt like it was one of those things where, you can really connect with your body. And I was, I was okay at it. I wasn't great, but it was something that was fun for me. I did a little bit of cross country then in high school. But running was just always something that I did for me. Like it was a conditioning thing for soccer. It was, the way that I kept in shape as I became, a grown up and didn't have sports to lean on anymore. And so running has always just sort of been there for me as like what I see it as is a very basic form of human movement and something that, I felt like no matter where I was, where I was living, I moved around a lot in my 20s, and I could always go for a run and feel better and get to know like where I was and all of that. So that's kind of my background with running. I'm not like a competitive runner. I'm not elite by any means, but it's something that I really enjoy.
Maggie, you mentioned, your parents were very supportive, and apparently, your brothers, it sounds like, were supportive as well. As and how old are you?
I'm 37.
Right. So this was, probably 20, 25 years ago. Did you at that age perceive a difference in your teams versus your brother's teams, or how kind of society looked at you and your involvement in sports versus your brother's, since you were like living side by side with them and competing side by side? Do you remember that many years ago, kind of feeling a difference between the two sports?
I remember there's a few things that I do remember because I, for the most part, I feel like girl soccer especially was like huge in Seattle in the 90s. Like it was actually very competitive, probably more competitive than boys soccer. But I will say, I know that I felt frustration at times, like with specifically, like I keep going back to like recess. Like I remember being like the only girl that wanted to like play football or whatever, like with the boys, or I wanted to be taken seriously or like in gym class, things like that. And I remember kind of feeling frustrated at times with that. Like, oh, why are the girls being separated out at gym class when the boys are learning how to wrestle or doing the, these kinds of things, and just kind of questioning that because, yeah, seeing how my brothers were expected kind of to play sports, but for me it was kind of seen as a, oh, that's like you're a sporty girl, like, and to me I was like, but I'm just a kid, like I'm just doing what they do. They're not considered like super athletic just because they play a sport every season, right? That's kind of, I'm sure anyone who played a school sport in the past 20, 30 years probably experienced that, the teams that get the attention are usually like the football team, maybe the basketball team, and those are boys' teams almost always, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's still going on today. Both of our kids are in high school. They play sports, and we definitely see a difference today with how the student body treats the boys' teams versus the girls' teams. Even if both teams are playing equally well, or even if the girls' teams are playing much better that season, inevitably the boys' teams tend to get more attention in the same sport. And hopefully that will continue to evolve and change. It certainly improved since when we were kids, but it's certainly not great. So yeah,
Yeah.
absolutely. So you mentioned you are not an elite runner. Most of us are not, but you are an amazing writer and journalist. So before we dig into this book, talk to us a little bit about your career trajectory and what led you to write a book about women's running.
So I started writing about women in sports, really because I was writing about women and I was writing for a women's magazine for a while. And one of the things that I was tasked with there was researching women for a program we called the Women of the Year Awards. And I was always on the lookout kind of for amazing women doing amazing things. And to me that meant athletes as well. And this was, oh gosh, probably 15 years ago. So a bit before, like we started talking about women athletes a little bit more in mainstream media. And that was a struggle. And it was a struggle to get those ideas approved. It was a struggle to, get people to pay attention. And so one of the things that I did was I went freelance, and I realized when I went freelance that one of the things I really wanted to focus on was women's sports and kind of focusing on it as almost like a business issue and almost as a feminist issue. And I really started to dig into that. And this was the year of the 2015 Women's World Cup. And so it was the USA winning the second World Cup that they'd won in a row. And it did started to break through a little bit after that. And then I noticed what I noticed was people didn't want the stories after the World Cup, right? And so it sort of became this thing that I would write about every 4 years for the Olympics or for the World Cup or things like that. When people would come to me and say, "Oh, you write about women's sports." And then really the big breakthrough came, I believe, when the US women's soccer team filed their lawsuit for equal pay. And that became something that I could write about in this more cultural way, and to sort of explain that, there it's not just about it's not just about the money, and it's not just about trying to prove that women can do what men can do, because it's not about that. It's about like how we view women athletes in our society. And so I knew I wanted to write a book that focused on that idea. So yeah, so when I was looking at this book, I knew that running was a really great opportunity to explore this idea. Like I said, I think running is a really basic human movement. And so for that reason, it feels like a really good place to dig into just research of movement and physical capability. But also, I knew some of these historical stories that in my mind had kind of been built up as moments that people point to when they talk about inequality in women's sports, right? Like the 1928 Olympics, when the 800 meter race, supposedly all of these women fell down or convulsed or whatever it was. And that's why, all of these news organizations, even today, will say that's why it took so long for long distance running for women. And then, of course, like images like of the Boston Marathon with Katherine Switzer. And, this is the one that people tell me about immediately if I say I'm working on something like this about women and running is, "Oh, have you seen the picture of the woman who's getting pushed out of the Boston Marathon?" And this lives in our mind for a reason, right? It's really striking. And so I knew I wanted to kind of like dig into those. And the more that I dug into those historical moments, the more it became about, oh, these were stories we were told that were untrue. And so what's the reality here? And what did these women go through? And also, what does it mean that we have so many myths around this one activity for women alone? And how has that kind of impacted our society on a bigger level?
I think it's an important and interesting point that you bring up, that the narratives that go with a lot of these pictures don't always tell the full truth. And that's something we even as runners and running coaches and learned as we got to meet Katherine Switzer or get to meet other runners from that ran around that same time. When you actually hear the story of what was going on, it's different than the images that we saw and the kind of the narratives that we were given. So why do you think that women this narrative is created? Why do you think that women are kind of dismissed or discouraged from engaging in physical activity? And these stories were kind of created around it to support that narrative.
Well, there's a lot of reasons, but the thing that I kind of trace it back to in the book is this: the creation of modern sporting events, the creation of modern athletics, kind of goes back to when the modern Olympics were revived in 1896. That's sort of when a lot of these people were having a little bit more time to do things like sports, and that was also a moment where the idea of femininity and masculinity was really being defined socially. And that was in order to kind of create these families, right? That we needed to like keep our economy going. We needed women to stay at home and take care of the babies. There was a lot of social anxiety around like the birth rate and around women trying to vote and trying to enter the workplace, and around like the white race being taken over by Black people who had just been emancipated from slavery, by immigrants who were coming in from around the world, right, to America. And so there was a lot of insistence that women were frailer than they were, right? And we just didn't know. Like, medicine and science were really very basic back then. It was very also full of myth and misunderstanding. And so one of the biggest things was this insistence that women were built for fertility, right? And were built to have babies. And there was a lot of fear actually too around what if some of these things that women want to do are harmful, right? And are going to harm their ability to have children. The other thing about that is that, we know that they could see at the time, right, that women could do things. There were plenty of women who were doing hard physical labor. There were plenty of women working in factories doing hard physical labor. There were women working in homes doing hard domestic labor. And so we could see that when we look back on it, right, we're like, we know that this did not impact, that women's bodies were capable of doing hard things. And we know that now, and we know how hard just getting pregnant and having babies is on women's bodies, right? And that you need to actually be like a strong and active person to do these kinds of things. But there was so much, fear and anxiety really around maintaining the status quo. And that meant, men were in all of the positions of power. Men were in all of the seats of government. And they wanted to continue making those decisions. They didn't want women to have the vote. They didn't want women to take their jobs. They didn't want women to not marry them and raise their babies. And so, really being very controlling around what women were allowed to do, is part of the reason that when we look at athletics, they were told that they were not allowed to do something, but it wasn't because they weren't allowed. The lie that was told was they're incapable.
It's so interesting because reading about some of the myths, there are so many that are featured in the book. You kind of don't know as a reader, are these myths generated from poor journalism or from poor science? It's hard to tell. And sometimes while reading it, I was wondering, were there instances, I'm sure there were, where writers were reporting on an event like the 800 that you mentioned, and perhaps they did report on it accurately, and someone above them shut the story down and said, no, that's not what happened. So it just makes you wonder from a bigger perspective, when you zoom out, we know this already. There are a lot of inaccuracies in media, and how we have more checks and balances now because there is video everywhere. There wasn't then, but you just wonder, how were these myths perpetuated? Through science or through reporting? It was probably a little bit of both.
Yes, there is so much misinformation and so many instances of inaccuracies in media. And one of the things that the ways that I researched this book was really digging into archives, newspaper archives, and reading what was written at the time around all of these events. And it's early journalism, early newspaper journalism was very kind of embellished and fantastical. There were not a lot of checks and balances on it. And so it's very interesting to read those things. The other thing that's really interesting when I was reading about the 1928 Olympics, for instance, is that nothing really matched up, right? So there's an inaccuracy if there's eight different stories that all say a different thing that happened, and you do have to kind of wonder, like, okay, where did this come from? And to me, I don't think that I don't want to say nothing nefarious was going on, just clearly misogyny that was ruling the ideas that people had and held societally. And so it felt okay to say something like, oh, I heard that all of these women fell down and it was a terrible situation. And, maybe that reporter wasn't even there. We don't know. Like, and there's no way to know about some of those things. Some of the reporting that I read, even on Mary Decker in the 1980s, that was very concerning to me. When she started running, she actually started running in the late 70s. She was a young girl. The way that the press wrote about her, you know, I mean, the press in general at that time was very male, but sports journalism, it like was extremely male. So you have to wonder, you know, who were the people making these decisions writing about this? She wasn't even, I think she was 12 when she ran her first marathon, like not even a teenager. And the ways that these narratives continued then into the 80s and 90s as she kept running, because she ran for so long, she had such an incredible career. You know, it was really quite upsetting actually to read, especially as it started to cross into my own lifetime and thinking about the messages that I was given as a girl and how we described and defined, you know, girls' bodies and women's bodies and what they should look like and what was concerning. And so there's a lot of media misinformation and media criticism in the book for that reason. But, you know, I think what is interesting about that is you're right. Like, there's also this kind of conversation between the science that's gone on and the medicine and the sports research and how that gets portrayed to the public. Right. You know, I think some of that is really to blame for how we've defined women athletes for so long as just, you know, point blank inferior. Like, there's just this idea that, like, oh, because science says this, because a man can run a 4-minute mile and a woman just broke the 5-minute mile, like there's this extreme difference in what we can do, and this inferiority that's kind of baked in. But in reality, you know, we don't really know. We didn't really know a lot of that. And about like why people could run the way that they could run and how we end up giving these opportunities to break records, because sometimes, you know, it's reported that Dionne Leather broke the 5-minute mile, but she wasn't even allowed to run miles. Like, there were no official records for miles. So it really was not on the same scale as what Roger Bannister had done. I think that that's an interesting part of how we have this conversation, especially around athletics, because it is so science-based and research-based. But also there's so many incredible human stories that people want to write about, but they might not understand all of it together. So that is kind of part of what I was trying to do in the book, was bring all of that together.
Maggie, you talked a little bit about, and we were kind of alluding to before, that way back in 1928, media and press coverage was very different because we were relying on, or, you know, firsthand accounts. And now we have videos, we have social media, and things have changed with journalism over the years. But we're still not quite at a point where, you know, we still have issues with coverage of women's sports. And that's still a conversation that we're still having. What do you think needs to change in kind of the journalism and media world for our perceptions of women and the portrayals of women to be more accurate and less have this kind of this less inherent, like you said, baked in, this less baked in or inherent bias?
A lot needs to happen. I mean, journalism in general is struggling, right? But we do need more investment in it. We need more investment just in sports journalism that is strictly focused on women. We really don't have a lot of that. I mean, local media coverage in general has really diminished in recent years. And that's, I think, part of the problem, because if you have not a very big sports department, right, in your newspaper, you're probably not going to allocate resources to the women's soccer team or the track meet that's happening in your town, right? Or if you do, it's going to be the intern or the low man on the totem pole, right? So I think also, I just, you know, when I started doing this, there have been women doing really great work in journalism covering women athletes for a long time, but it's just so hard to get the attention. And, We've seen this shift. I mean, I've been very interested in just the last few years, of course, how things have shifted a bit, how we do have women athletes who are household names now, like, and a lot of them are more famous than men, right? Than I think most people can name women on the US national soccer team, but not on the men's. So that's a really interesting development, I'd say. And I do think that some of that is from more and better media coverage and people who have done this really out of passion, not because someone started a position at a institutional media for them to cover women's sports. It's a lot of people, like me who have done this on a freelance basis, who have started their own blogs or newsletters and are kind of building that up from the ground. So I'd love to see, more investment in those kind of people who have been doing this work for a long time. And I also just think, I mean, there's just so much stereotype in the way that we still cover women. And I think some of that is in part because of that, like, kind of male perspective that often comes with sports journalism. And I mean, there's still things like the amount of time that we see women on ESPN or something like that, right? Like, it's still a little bit shocking when you look into how little coverage there is. So really, I mean, I think just more coverage. We've been seeing a lot of, like, I guess traditionally, like, women's magazines and women's media companies starting to cover women's sports, and I do think that that's good. But I again, it's almost like you get things from different perspectives, right? So, like, I'm curious to see how things will change and turn out when, more women athletes are in vogue and things like that, like how that's going to impact the serious journalism and sports coverage that they get too. I think that remains to be seen.
Well, big shout out to people like Allyson Wade, who developed Fast Women just for the sole purpose of covering women runners. And I think her, which once I thought looked like sort of a project, has become basically mainstream journalism for running, has really allowed so
Absolutely.
many of us to be able to learn about athletes we may not know about otherwise. So, shifting gears a little bit, speaking of coverage, even within women's running, you talk about the fact that women of color are so underrepresented in women's running, and that dates back, of course, to in the first Black American woman to win an Olympic medal. Nobody really knows about her. Mickey Patterson. We know about Jesse Owens, but we've never heard about her. Can you talk a little bit about her and what her role was in women's running and what happened as a result of her win?
Yeah. Oh, I love Mickey Patterson. Her story is just like one. It was one of my favorite finds because, yeah, I think there was like kind of a there was like an internet meme that went around a while ago, and it was like, who's the first Black woman to win a gold medal? And everybody was answering Wilma Rudolph, and in fact, it's actually Alice Coachman who won a gold medal for the high jump in the 1948 Olympics. And at that same Olympics, the even lesser known story is that actually the first Black woman to win a medal at all was Mickey Patterson, and she won the bronze in the 200 meter, I believe. She was a woman who was a great runner, and she was one of these women who ended up going to an HBCU. She went to Tennessee State. At the time, Tennessee was building a track program that looked like Tuskegee's track program, the Tuskegee Institute, which was just dominating women's athletics at the time, women's track and field. And that's because in the 1940s, actually, most white women were again not running and being told and being kind of like pushed back aside after the 1928 debacle and in through the 1930s, you know, there was just sort of this time period, especially during the war, where women were kind of told to get back home and we needed to like reestablish these gender roles, and white women in particular were kind of being pushed into very feminine pastimes, and that kind of coincided with the rise of PE, of gym classes, and there was very, very, very gendered ideas of what girls should be doing during PE. School sports was not really a thing at all, of course, especially for girls. It was for boys. Football was big still. But yeah, so what kind of happened was seeing these names like Jesse Owens, seeing how the success that some of these Black men were having becoming national names, that inspired some of these HBCUs in the South to start women's teams as well. And it was because, you know, this was this time period pre-civil rights, like they're having to try to convince American society, especially in the South, that women or that Black people were, you know, able to do big and important things too. And this was a way to kind of gain some respect. And so it was an interesting thing for some of these schools because they also didn't want to keep adding to the stereotype that Black women were kind of stronger or more brutish or things like that. So they also, you know, had these women, they were going to beauty classes, they were going to elocution classes, things like that. They had to travel to track meets, you know, wearing certain things and wearing makeup and having their hair done and things like that. But that wasn't really interesting. That thing that happened was at the 32 and 36 Olympics, there was a big dust up that two Black women were on the track and field team. They were named Tydee Pickett and Louise Stokes, and they were both named as potentials for the relay. And there was this big, big dust up, especially in 32. Neither of them were allowed to run. They had been kind of named as like they were definitely going to be on the team, and then at the last minute, the coach went with four white women instead. And so it was very interesting because then the following Olympics, they were also the only two Black women on the team. And in a very tragic moment, Tydee Pickett actually injured herself on a hurdle and wasn't able to keep going in any of her events. She had actually qualified in a few events that year. And Louise Stokes again was left off of the track team. But by 1948, which is post-war, you know, we missed two Olympics because of the wars. And in 1948, the majority of the team was made up of Black women. There were actually only, I think, two or three white women on the team because of this shift that had happened, right? In the way that we were encouraging white women not to participate in things like this. And track was really, really part of this social movement that encouraged women not to overexert and not to become mannish or masculine. There was a lot of societal fear around that at the time. And so, yeah, so as a result, we had this incredibly strong group of Black women, and that included Mickey Patterson, who was just a great runner. She was super young. She was in college at the time. She won bronze, but we really didn't hear about it. There was, even at the time, there wasn't much fanfare. There wasn't much media coverage. Alice Coachman got a little bit because she won the gold. But I, you know, in my media deep dive into these archives, I didn't even find a photo of Mickey like getting her medal. Nothing, which was pretty incredible when we think back on it. She was from New Orleans, and when she came home, her high school, which was an all-Black high school, like the marching band was there to greet her when she got home. But that was like all that she got. There was no parade, there was no, mayor, nothing. And when you think about today, like we treat Olympians so well in terms of at least like giving them their flowers. So Mickey was a really fascinating woman, and she actually devoted her life to coaching track and field. And she ended up coaching in San Diego because she couldn't get a job in Louisiana. She couldn't get a job in the South, because no one would hire a Black woman. And even when she came back, there was a story I stumbled across too, that she did want to go back to the Olympics, and so she was trying to train, and the parks in her neighborhood were segregated. Like she had to literally, I think one of them gave her like special permission to run there, but just to even have to do something like that is pretty wild. And yeah, she started her own teams in San Diego, and she specifically focused on underrepresented, underprivileged kids and girls, and getting more underprivileged Black kids, especially to the kind of opportunities that lead to the Olympics, because now it's such a privileged place to be, to even be able to be trained and go to the events that you need to go to be noticed, or to get the kinds of things that you need done to actually make it as an Olympic athlete today.
Yeah, I found it really just interesting and to read kind of the history and the story of these women and what they did after, and how they kind of fought, still had to keep fighting after for any kind of attention or any kind of recognition. So that was it's pretty remarkable, and I think some people would say that still continues to today. So I think a lot of these trends that we're seeing, these are things we think would improve over time. But they seem to still, it's so like I think you said, baked into our culture and our perceptions, which I think is still a struggle to overcome. And related, and kind of shifting to a related but sort of a different a kind of this baked in discrepancy. But you talk about a lot about how the separation between men and women's running is based on societal norms and culture. How do you think that our treatment of women's running has sort of impacted the progression over the years? Like, how do you, I mean, like, we still have now, when we look at I know there's a lot of discussion lately over coverage of even the Olympic trials, or any competitions. Whenever we see the women's race covered versus the men's race covered, there's still some discrepancy there. So how do you think that kind of those societal norms versus the science, because we've talked a little about the science, but how do you think about those societal norms are still impacting that discrepancy to today?
Oh, I mean, I think it's huge, and it's impossible to know the extent, right? But I think that's part of what I've tried to do in the book, is sort of trace this evolution, right, of how we've held women back at various points, and just literally not allowing women to have races at distance for so long. I mean, this is extremely recent history. Like, Catherine Switzer is not that old, like, it's a very recent thing, and I think a lot about how, when my mom was born in 1955, when she grew up, like, that was the era when people were told, you literally are incapable of running something like a marathon. Not even a marathon. I mean, at that time, the longest official race was 1 mile for women. Like, this is bonkers to think how much that has changed. But again, like, yes, it's changed, and yes, I grew up thinking I could run whatever I wanted, but those things are still there, right? Like, it still lives in our mind, it still lives in our societal memory. So are the people who are still running TV coverage for marathon trials, are those people who still, have something in their mind around, about, oh, these women are really amazing because they, they broke through all these barriers to do this, but why did they have to do that? It's because we had these perceptions, right, for so long about what women were literally incapable of. And if that lives in our society still, you know, there's going to be repercussions. There's going to be effects in terms of yeah, like how we cover them, or even what the expectation is, right? Like, and that, you know, as runners, I'm sure you know, like thinking of what you're expected to do really impacts what you're able to do, right? So I think just even having those kinds of messages around, you know, women's running even being something that had to be fought for, you know, really impacts this idea that, you know, maybe it wasn't natural, or maybe it wasn't as, you know, easy as like men who, you know, we still have this story too today, right? That men were the hunters and men had to go out and chase down tigers, and that's how humans survived and evolved. Well, we actually don't know that's what happened. We don't know how all of the different human societies have evolved. You know, and when we have those things in our mind, it just really impacts, I think, you know, what we talk about when we talk about women athletes. And the other thing that I'll point out is, you know, this idea that in the 80s and 90s, there was a lot of messaging around, again, trying to get the science out to the mainstream through the media about the female athlete triad, and what the sports scientists were trying to say was, you know, these girls are having certain effects, and really getting hurt because they're not being trained correctly, they're not fueling enough, they're not, you know, they're being treated like boys and it's not working. And what we've, you know, what the media ended up really giving the message about was that it sort of sounded like girls aren't cut out to run. Girls aren't cut out to do this kind of sporting thing. So we need to like treat them very carefully. And look, it's going to be really dangerous. And even today, you sometimes get that messaging, right? Like, oh, this is going to be really, it might be really impossible for this girl to walk onto her high school football team because she might get hurt. And it's like, well, the boys might get hurt too. You know, why do we treat these things, you know, still in our head as very separate and very much like this underlying idea of fragility, I think just still really exists.
You bring up a lot of great points. I think one of which is the female athlete triad, and what is the genesis of that? Is it how women are quote unquote supposed to look as runners, and the whole lighter is faster? It really doesn't work well. Looking at Mary Decker's trajectory, which is just mind-boggling, all of the surgeries that Mary went through. And of course, the way the media described her when she came on the scene as light and tiny, and she probably really identified that way and felt that that's the body she needed to maintain to remain fast. And then, of course, fast forward to another Mary, Mary Kane, of course, and the way she was coached by a man who has impacted, of course, Kara Goucher too, and probably countless others on his perception of what a female athlete should look like, and in the meantime, caused a lot of injury. So it's again the chicken or the egg problem. Is it science? Is it the media? Is it both? But that has caused so much pain for women's running and for women runners. And it still continues today, the way social media works. Of course, we are so much more educated, but there is still so much diet culture messaging out there. And we as women athletes continue to struggle with, you know, what to eat, how much to eat, how to fuel. And I know male athletes struggle with it too, but the conversation is not quite as robust.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, writing that part of the book was really, it's really hard, right? It's like, it's so sad because I think women athletes on that front especially have been done such a disservice. So many of these stories are really tragic. Like they're very tragic that they're girls and women, young women who were extremely talented, and literally their bodies broke down, you know, their minds broke down because of these messages and the ways that they were framed. And I think it's both. It's definitely media and it was science. It was science really not catching up. Because you had these wonderful, some wonderful women who were doing this sports science and really focusing on this and starting to put the pieces together. But they weren't necessarily, you know, being taken seriously in their own fields. And when they were, it's also just about getting the word out. Like, that's what was so shocking to me was that, you know, even in the most recent studies that have been done, most coaches don't know about these things. Most coaches don't know what red S is or how to identify it or what the signals are. And you know, I've been talking to you know, lots of runners over the period of researching this and also just in the aftermath. And even very recent college runners, you know, we've seen the stories, we've seen the media coverage of college coaches at elite programs that are still leaning on these ideas. And even the ones that aren't getting into trouble, you know, I've heard from runners who've said, of course my coach will tell me, you know, don't eat that, don't eat that. This is bad food. You're looking fit when you've lost weight, you know, things, those messages, they just persist. And it's really sad, you know, because of course it hurts us. And it hurts lots of girls and women for different reasons. But also when you look at it from a strictly sports perspective, like, think of all the careers that have been ruined. Think of all the potential that we haven't been able to find or that hasn't been able to, you know, show to its max capacity because they simply were told that their bodies like weren't cut out for this because they weren't skinny enough. And that's just, I mean, that's just heartbreaking.
Sort of related to that, but how do you think women like Jasmine Paris are changing that narrative? And along those lines, we've talked about some of the misperceptions and some of the maybe implied or actually inherent character traits that women have that have caused this narrative. But what do you think specific to Jasmine Paris and maybe women like her, but what characteristics and what traits, unique traits, do you think that women have that give them an advantage, whether that be at the long distance? I know chapter of your book talks about, you know, longer distance and women having maybe an advantage at the longer distance. But what characteristics and traits have you seen in your research that have given women like Jasmine, but more broadly speaking, an advantage?
Yeah, I mean, I think today that's what's really interesting is you know, these ultra distance runners who are able to run against men and who are able to beat them, and you know, that's of course like not the point of sports, but I think that it does make a difference in terms of the image and again, like changing our perceptions of what's possible. And Jasmine Paris is incredible. I mean, she's just a wonderful human, and her win of the spine race, you know, while she was pumping breast milk for her baby, and shattered the record, just shattered it, is just such a great story. And she really will talk about, you know, like I was a mom of a 1-year-old. I was up all night anyway. You know, I have, you know, and she'd been doing things like hiking her whole life. You know, she'd been running in the mountains her whole life. She was able to train for that race just like putting her baby on her back and walking through the woods or running through the woods. And that's such an incredible thing to me is also just like the reframe, right? Like that we don't have to constantly compare ourselves directly to men as on this like purely biological basis, right? But we can also see that like all of us do have different lives and we do have a lot of strengths Some of the biological research will say that women's muscles recover faster, that we tire less easily, and I think we all know that. I think we do see some of those things. We see a lot of mental toughness that has been built up, and I think part of that is also the societal and historical memory, right, of like being told you're not capable, right? And so especially, I think, for younger people today who have grown up kind of knowing that, like, that's BS and like that those are myths, like, that creates this kind of edge in you, right? Like, when you look at, I mean, even just like Mary Decker, like, she was running against everything. She had to like convince the coaches in Oregon to take her on by convincing the wives of the other runners. Like, can you imagine being in that position and like the grit you'd have just to keep going? So I think a lot of it is that, is like proving ourselves still and having this like grit and mental toughness that is part of running and is part of sport. And I think that's the other beautiful thing that I took from this book was, really remembering that like sport isn't just about like calculating numbers and the fastest times and the world records. It's really about, human competition and humanity and like how you draw on the things inside of you and your own past and your own, ambition to compete. And yeah, I mean, I think some of those women ultra distance runners are great examples of what we can look to when we see that maybe the future of sport and running looks totally different, right? Like, maybe we have been selling ourselves short this whole time, and who knows what else we're capable of. And I think that's kind of the beauty of sport when it comes down to it.
Yeah, none of us are running because we're trying to win gold medals. We're running against ourselves out of a place of curiosity to see what we can do and see how far we can go. And certainly your book illuminates all of the struggles that those before us women runners have had to go through. And I argue that elevating women also elevates men. It's for all sport. It's good for all of us for women to be able to run or play to their fullest potential with all of the resources and all of the coverage. So, thank you so much for bringing all of these issues to light and particularly sharing so many stories of incredible athletes that many of us don't necessarily know much about, if at all. Your book is wonderful. Can you share a little bit about its release date and also where people can find you?
Absolutely. Yeah. So, Better, Faster, Farther will be on sale June 18th, about a month before the Olympics begin. And I'll be on the West Coast doing a bit of a book tour at the time. You can find it in any of your local independent bookstores or online.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today, Maggie. It was a great conversation. And for those interested in ordering the book, when we talked to past authors, they've mentioned that it's always helpful to order in advance, before the release date. So can folks order your book online now, even though it's not being released till June?
Absolutely, yes. Go to any of your bookstores and click the pre-order button.
Fabulous. Well, thanks so much for joining us today, Maggie. And we wish you all the best with your book launch, and we really appreciate your time today. Happy
Great. Thank
running.
you. Thank you so
Thanks,
much.
Maggie.
Thank you so much for listening to the Run Farther and Faster Boston Marathon podcast. We want to give a special thanks to our editor, Aaron Bryant. And if you enjoyed this episode and enjoy listening to our podcast, please share it with others. And please leave a review if you haven't done so already on iTunes. Thanks for listening and have a great week.